Chapter 29. Entertaining in Style. As my Christmas holiday in Nairobi continued, my father and Allison announced that they would be hosting a dinner party at the house the following Saturday night. I had no idea what was involved, or what part I was to play in it, if any, but it wasn't long before I found out. The guest list was discussed, and, for my benefit, each invitee was described in detail. But a pall of disappointment descended when I realized they were all oldies, not one of them was in my age group. I knew immediately that it'd be yet another Nairobi dinner party, where, out of a sense of duty, I felt obliged to feign interest in boring subjects, with insincere nods and phony smiles. At each gathering, I'd noticed that the over-dinner conversations I had with my fellow guests became less and less coherent, as more and more alcohol was consumed. Here, dinner party planning was controlled from Command Central, Allison's antique writing bureau. From the bureau came the blue hardcover dinner party book, recording the details of every previous dinner party they'd hosted together. The pages contained the names of the invitees, the menu, the wine served with each course, and the date. This information was vital because, if any of the dinner party elements were spotted being repeated, it'd reflect badly on Granger dinner party design. And loss of face was to be avoided at all costs. My father and Allison discussed the menu at length. Once it was finalized, my father then matched his cellar wines with each course to be served. Soup, entree, main course and dessert. Forward planning gave Allison and Mariba, their domestic servant, plenty of time to shop and cook whatever could be prepared ahead of time. This was important to minimize the possibility of a culinary disaster on the night. The Saturday morning of the dinner party dawned bright and clear. After breakfast, the house went into overdrive, with the main focus being the dining room. This was an elevated space, with a highly polished timber floor, situated between the living room and the kitchen, two steps up from each. These steps required care and concentration to negotiate, both upwards and downwards. They were particularly tricky for Mariba too. Each day, in response to a tinkling bell, Mariba brought numerous hot dishes to the table with poise and gravitas, always dressed immaculately in a white monkey suit, topped off with a red fez, with a black tassel, and white sand shoes. My father and Allison had a splendid Chippendale dining suite that seated eight with a matching Chippendale sideboard. On the sideboard, between a pair of three-armed silver candelabra, there was always a spherical crystal vase, holding long-stemmed red and white carnations. The carnations matched the rich red and cream colors of the patterned Persian carpet on which stood the antique table and chairs. Fresh carnations and candles materialized for the dinner party. The sideboard contained all the fancy trappings for this gastronomic extravaganza. The porcelain dinner set, crystal drinkware, sterling silver cutlery, cruet sets, vases for the smaller floral table arrangements, and the other paraphernalia necessary to complete the table setting. Earlier in the week, Mariba had carefully polished, rinsed and dried all the silver needed for the gathering. The final task was to set the table. But before this could happen, the perfectly laundered, starched and ironed linen tablecloth was unfolded and smoothed out on top of a 2 centimeter thick underlay of dense woolen felt, cut to the exact size of the table top. With my father supervising, the tablecloth was tugged gently this way and that, to ensure even overhang on all sides, after which the folds were ironed out of the tablecloth, the felt pad protecting the table surface from the heat. Now the pristine white tablecloth was perfectly creaseless, table setting could begin. Throughout the dinner party preparations, I felt like a spare wheel. I wasn't asked to contribute in any way. I was simply an observer, whilst a set of sequential tasks was conducted around me, with the precision of a carefully choreographed dance. It was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. Before visiting my father and Allison, my at-home dinner party exposure was quite limited. My mother, a single woman living and working in the New Guinea Highlands, was often invited out to dinner by blokes, keen to be in the company of an attractive, intelligent, and amusing single woman, in a country where they were in short supply. As a result, I had little dinner party modeling on which to draw on. All was in readiness for the guests, and we were suitably dressed up to greet them. Surprisingly, my father and Allison displayed no outward signs of the hours of hard slog they'd put into preparing for the gathering. My father had devised a clever ploy to deliver his guests to the dining table sufficiently sober to appreciate Allison's cooking. To do this, he needed to limit their intake of alcoholic spirit, the favored pre-dinner tipple of many Anglo expatriates in Africa. His was a sherry offensive. With a flourish, he wheeled in a drinks trolley loaded with 40 different sherries, or so he said, sourced from wineries across the world. He would then deliver a rehearsed spiel, briefly describing each fortified wine on offer, sweet, medium and dry. His guests, so enthralled with his performance, would acquiesce and choose a sherry rather than their customary sundowner of brandy, whiskey or gin. I was told it worked every time, and it did. The dinner party was a great success and the food magnificent, as Allison was an exceptional cook. The wines were delicious and the company interesting, despite my earlier misgivings. Yes, the guests were middle-aged or older, but not at all boring. Next morning, when the house had returned to normal, we conducted a systematic dinner party debrief over a welcome cup of tea, after which Allison added the details of this gathering to her dinner party book. On reflection. The damask tablecloth. All these decades later, my memory of my father ironing the tablecloth on the table stays with me. At the time, I was conflicted. Both astounded and at the same time scathing, as I watched the care with which my father prepared the tablecloth for the dinner party. His attention to detail was breathtaking, and his performance was a revelation for which I'm eternally grateful. I've wholeheartedly adopted his modus operandi in my own career, producing cutting-edge artwork in which every aspect of the work is considered. The content, the aesthetics, the construction, and the problem-solving necessary when breaking new ground. Like my father, I overlook nothing, and I wonder if this could be considered an example of the apple not falling far from the tree? Sherry. In retrospect, my father's success in controlling his guests' intake of pre-dinner alcohol was yet another example of his need to control his environment and those in it. His, my way or the highway credo, enabled him to justify his decisions, irrespective of dissent. It gradually dawned on me that I was sitting on a time bomb. Dinner parties? Since 1969 Nairobi, I've come to realize that throwing dinner parties was a prerequisite for middle-class Australian couples, both before and after children. Shortly after I partnered, I bought a terrace house which we completely renovated, including a tiny dining room. I then furnished it with an oval single-pedestal cedar dining table and six balloon-backed cedar chairs. Now, with a flash dining room, we too succumbed to societal pressure and began holding dinner parties. Like my father and Allison, activity began early on Saturday morning with fresh food shopping at the market, cleaning the house and preparing the various courses, but without the help of servants. As a result, by the time the guests arrived, I was exhausted. After a couple of drinks, I found it difficult to sustain the role of a perfect hostess and serve the various courses I'd sweated blood preparing. I just wanted to go to sleep. When the relationship faltered and finally failed, I was thankful to leave the dinner party ritual behind. After which I promised myself, I'd never cook again. I planned to express my creativity in other more long-lasting ways.